At the end of every day, I drive through the city of New Haven and cross the bridge that will take me home.
I love this part. This is the part where he says my name twice.
Unless there are construction delays.
What?
Currently, there is closure on the Route 34 eastbound ramps to both I-91 and I-95 northbound.
Who cares? Why isn't he saying my name?
So then, I might take exit 43 and use First Avenue to the alternate northbound ramp. I feel the words building inside me. I can't stop them or tell you why I say them.
Now we're back on track.
But as I reach the top of the bridge, these words come to me in a whisper. I say these words as a prayer, as regret, as praise.
Here it comes.
I say rutabaga, jellyfish.
What? Hey, you, in the car.
Who's talking?
You're supposed to say Wolfenstein. Wolfenstein.
Why would I say that?
Well, why do you say the other ones?
I'm just hoping we have rutabagas for dinner. My wife mashes them with butter, and they're really...
Stop talking about your wife. I hate your wife. It's me you're obsessed with. Me. Me, me.
If you say so.
And why do you say jellyfish?
I'm going over water. Maybe I'm thinking about them. How do I know? I'm no psychiatrist.
No, I'm a psychiatrist. Oh my God, you're barely following this story.
I have a lot on my mind.
No, you have one thing on your mind, and that's me. That's the whole point. Me. The whole point is me. What part of me do you not understand? Don't answer that. I'm too upset. I need to just listen to this show about me. And now he doesn't need people, and he doesn't care. Colin McEnroe.
Yes, we are. We are. We are doing a show about Barbara Streisand today. I hope that became clear during that intro. So, and it's going to be all about Barbara. And if she's listening, I think she'll enjoy it a lot. Joining us in studio, Jacques Lamar. He is the reason we're doing this. He is playwright and director of communication and special events at the Mark Twain House and Museum. And if you like Jacques Lamar, you're going to be very happy because he'll be back in 2 days to do the nose, either through a master stroke of planning on my part or some, I don't know. I'm perfectly happy with that. Tracy Moore is also coming back to our studio. She is a singer, associate professor of theater at the Hart School of Music and the University of Hartford. We felt like we should have a singer. She's performed in the National Broadway tours along with Off-Broadway regional theater productions, and she's the author of Acting the Song, Performance Skills for the Musical Theater. Ha. Joining us by phone is Thomas Santopietro, author of 5 books, including The Importance of Being Barbara, and most recently, The Sound of Music Story. He spent 25 years as a manager of over 30 Broadway shows. And Jonathan Tolens, he is playwright and author of Buyer and Seller, currently at TheaterWorks through February 14th. That's sort of the main reason we're doing the show. Jacques called this to our attention and said, you should do a whole show about Barbara. And it's a great idea. He's also adapting Grease Live for Fox TV on January 31st and is the consulting producer for Brain Dead. Oh, boy. there was anything called Brain Dead. That could be the title of so many things, actually. All right. So Barbara Streisand. I mean, she was first and foremost this great singing talent, but she became so many other things. And in some ways, it's a story about refusing to accept limitations and refusing to be marginalized and refusing to be told that you can't do this, or you can't do that because you're a woman, because you're Jewish, because you're not conventionally beautiful. I think you could even argue that she single-handedly altered, in at least a slight way, our whole attitude about beauty in America. So many things. But a lot of it does come, I think, from this notion of a person refusing to be boxed in and pushing back and then getting pushed back against her pushing back. And it's turned into a very interesting story. She's 73 years old right now. And so we're going to talk about sort of that enduring quality that she has. But Thomas Santopietro, you know, as much as she's fascinating to a lot of people right now, and as much as she does have an enduring, iconic quality, in some ways, it's not quite the same as it was in the 1960s and 1970s, right? I mean, I'm assuming that's the time when she occupied a real center stage in the American cultural conversation.
Oh, I think that's right, because, as you said, she really did change the notions of beauty in the country. You know, her talent became beauty. And, of course, over the decades, you know, she was a rebel in the 60s. She started at the era when Doris Day was the biggest star in the world. And so, you know, what time does to every rebel is it makes them a part of the establishment. So she's had quite a journey in that way as well.
And Jonathan Tolins, I think it is important to sort of sketch out your play. I was lucky enough to see it in one of its earlier incarnations at the Barrow Street Theater. And it deals a little bit more with Streisand as kind of a lioness in winter, a little bit later or close to the present in her career. And in this place that I didn't realize existed, this place, this kind of underground world, this subterranean city in her own home. Tell us about this.
Sure. Well, for those who don't know, in 2010, Barbara put out a book called My Passion for Design, which was a lavish coffee table book with pictures that she took herself of her estate in Malibu, which has three buildings on it. And one chapter is about the basement under the barn, I believe. And what she's done is instead of having closets or storage rooms to keep all of her old stuff that she's acquired over the course of her career, she created a little shopping mall. And it has a cobblestone street, and there is a doll shop and an antique shop and a clothing boutique and a gift shoppy, where, as we say in the play, where they sell extra letter P's and E's, apparently. And she has this little place that she takes friends down to see, and it's which she has everything arranged just so in ways that please her. And when that book came out, I just thought that was a little funny. And so I imagined what would happen if someone was hired to work down there and was sort of the shopkeeper, and what would happen when Barbara, like Marie Antoinette, would come down and pretend to shop. And that's where the idea came from.
And, you know, Tom Santopietro, I mean, this sort of plays in a little bit to one of the – there's so many storylines about Barbara Streisand, but one of them, I think, is this sort of permanently wounded person, this person who grew up poor, who didn't maybe get what she needed at the parental level. I think her father died when she was pretty young, maybe didn't get a lot of reinforcement from her mother. That there's sort of this sense that there's this permanent psychic wound that can't be healed, and maybe you get these kinds of extravagant attempts like the one that Jonathan's describing.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, you know, she herself admitted that when she made Yentl, it was an attempt to recreate her father on film, and because he died when she was 1.5. So there is, for all of her extraordinary success and this overwhelming confidence in some ways, there's still a very much a vulnerability about her, and that interests people. And of course, she, you know, it's why outsiders, as I call them, outsiders of all stripes, identify with her so much. And so her persona took on, especially in the beginning, this kind of Cinderella myth. And, you know, and yet on another level, she's very aware of that and very savvy about playing with that persona. So she's got about three levels going at the same time.
So we don't really think of Jacques Lemar as an outsider, but probably at one time you might have thought of yourself as an outsider.
Well, you know, I became a fan of Barbara Streisand's. You know, I would actually say, although you said, you know, she was kind of hugely innovative or whatever, you know, or held the cultural landscape in the 60s and 70s, but I think with the 80s, you know, that's when she does Yentl, which is her first directing thing, and then the Broadway album, which I think is probably her greatest single recorded work. That was the moment where I kind of keyed into her, and it was also the moment where I had that growing awareness of being gay and that kind of sort of outsider thing, particularly with Yentl. I swear I went in not having a sexuality, and then I came out and after watching Barbara Streisand pretend that she's a man and looking at Mandy Patinkin naked, I'm like, yeah, I'm gay.
Let's play your musical epiphany right
okay.
now. All right. This is from A Piece of the Sky.
Thank you.
Tracy Moore does have some suspicions about that particular clip, but if she says them, the other three guests will walk off the show immediately.
In that clip, you can hear that one of the things that makes her such a favorite, and also one of the things that makes her fun to write about, is that there's something indomitable about Barbara. It's one of the reasons why she's actually not really great at singing torch songs. Like, she's not a tragic figure. She's not someone like Judy Garland or Billie Holiday or someone who was self-destructive. Barbara just keeps going and getting what she wants, and there's that strength. That I think is also appealing to her outsider fans.
Well, I think there's also, and actually, Tracy, in a serious way, I'll have you speak to this. There's something about her vocal attack and about the production that goes behind it and stuff like that. That too much is never enough, right? That whatever it is, it could be taken to the next level. So let's try that.
I think she's a fabulous vocalist, and she obviously takes a lot of time in the studio and probably has the same attention to detail there that she does for her films. You know, you can imagine her being painstaking about the details. It's an incredible instrument, and she does so many things right as a singer. My thoughts on that last note, it is kind of an inhuman extension of sound, and it's entirely possible that it could be looped, in other words, but you know, I don't know for sure. That's a total guess. It could be she's just that amazing. I would be willing to accept that.
And Jacques, what does it matter if it is looped? I mean, this is about creating illusion. I mean, entertainment is about creating an illusion.
But I mean, there's also the fact that she's kind of superhuman in that way. I like to prefer to think that she, you know, and Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, like 10 years earlier, she did the same thing on Barbara Streisand and other musical instruments where she hits this note on I Got Rhythm and it just goes on for days and you can leave the room and you come back in and she's still singing that one note. So, you know, I mean, it's part of that. You know, she's better than most. So.
You gotta have faith. And you know, Jonathan, that sense also of kind of abundance or overabundance. I mean, that's sort of there in the play. That's there in the milieu that you're kind of describing too. That it's like, let's build a castle and then let's build a castle underneath the castle and let's build a castle alongside. And she kind of does that with everything.
Right. Well, one of the things that the play is about, and this isn't just specific to Barbara. I think it's of all people who reach that incredible level of fame, not that anyone else has her level of fame, but there is this need and the wound that you talked about earlier, the sense that nothing is ever enough. In fact, one of the things that's funny in her singing is that often she does these riffs where she's taking the vocal line in all different places. And there's a great joke that Gerard Alessandrini put in Forbidden Broadway, his show, where in the parody of the Broadway album, and she's singing to the tune of On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, she sings, "Tell Dick Rogers Some Enchanted Evening's Fixed." That Barbara's attention will improve everything it touches.
Well, Jonathan, one of the many questions about Barbara Streisand, or I'll put it another way, the American public will forgive you for all kinds of things, but it won't forgive you for not having a sense of humor about yourself. And so you either have to have one or you have to fake having one. And I think one of the raps against her, whether it's ever articulated this way or not, is that, you know, that she's different from Bette Midler. She's different from Lady Gaga in the sense that she takes all of this very, very seriously. There isn't any camp. And there isn't a sense of humor, and that maybe she'll invite Mike Myers to be in her audience and pretend to be Linda Richman and then bring Linda Richman up on stage and kind of play around with that. But it feels as though she's been coached into doing that.
Right. I couldn't have written up this play about someone like Bette Midler, who would always seem in on the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because, you know, her first major successes were in musical comedy, and although I mean there's a degree of pathos obviously to Funny Girl ultimately, but I mean she's playing Fanny Bryce, who was notoriously funny. And when you look at her films like What's Up Doc, where she's you know, she's very funny, although Madeline Kahn's funnier in that movie, you know, it is funny that she is kind of humorless about herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And watching her recent interview with Jimmy Fallon, I was like, you know, she turns around and starts kind of interviewing him, but she's really a bit joyless, which was surprising. And so many of her early songs were comic.
Let's just talk about why she started interviewing him.
Okay.
Okay.
That was because Barbara, whenever she goes on television, she prefers one side.
That's true.
So
when she went on Rosie O'Donnell's show years ago, they actually rebuilt the set to reverse it. And Rosie O'Donnell had to say, well, we just felt like doing things differently today. All right. And then Jimmy Fallon, they didn't build a new set, but they had this little ploy where she was going to get to interview him, so she got to sit on the side that she prefers.
But she wasn't even fun, you know. No. That was the thing that kind of killed me. And I keep waiting for because so much of her most recent work is really, you know, other than the, you know, Meet the Fockers and whatnot, which are, you know, kind of, I think, beneath her at this point in her career. But, I mean, the musical output's not interesting to me. I don't know if the other guests agree, but...
Well, before we get to that, too, I mean, Tom, one question that I have is, so this is a young woman who comes up and she gets her first attention in places like The Lion, right, with these gay clubs where she, I mean, no surprise that she's a gay icon. There's a lot of reasons for that, but one reason is that was really her first audience. And I just assume playing in those places, the fact that she could do it as a diva, could do it with drama, had just an incredible instrument, was important. But I have a hard time believing that she didn't have some kind of kitschy, campy thing to go with that. Do we know anything about what she was like sort of pre-61?
Well, I think, you know, what's happened is her persona has changed so much because of the level of stardom that she's achieved, which I think is really only paralleled by Sinatra, the only person I'm more obsessed with than I am with Barbara. And I think, you know, I just got it's a quasi-bootleg recording of her back at her very, very beginning in the 60s. And she was wild on the stage. I mean, the patter's hilarious. She's funny. She has a self-deprecating sense of humor. So you really measured against what you were just saying. You see the distance she's traveled in terms of her self-seriousness over 30, 40 years.
Jonathan, has Barbara Streisand ever seen Buyer and Seller?
No, she has not. Hmm. She's been asked about it several times, and there was talk that she was going to arrange to come see it when we were doing the show at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, but ultimately she decided not to see it. And I'm fine with that. I think it would be weird for her.
It will be. Say why you think it would be weird for her. I mean, this is the play kind of explores kind of maybe the two personae of hers that we're the most familiar with or that we suspect we know about.
Well, I think it would be weird because the show actually – I tried to not write a show that was not just a cheap shot or just jokes about Barbara. I really tried to imagine what it would be like to be her and what does it say about a person who builds a shopping mall in their basement. And in the show, she has a relationship with this young gay actor who gets hired to work for her. And you feel a sense of loneliness and a need to connect with other people, which is hard to do when you're the most famous person on the planet, pretty much, and everywhere you go, you are swarmed. So I think that would be it would be awkward for her. Also, in addition to that, because I didn't want to write just a play that would seem like a puff piece or a love letter, there is a character in the play named Barry, who is the main character's boyfriend, who brings up all of the criticism that has been leveled against Barbara throughout her career. And the play ultimately sides against Barry and against that cynicism and actually ultimately sides with sort of this celebration of, yes, she may be humorless sometimes and she may be crazy, but she's this extraordinary talent and has done wonderful things. But if you're Barbara sitting in the theater having to listen to some of that stuff with the audience around you laughing, might be uncomfortable.
And Jacques, isn't that part of being a Barbara fan is maybe it's almost part of the kind of a sub hobby that goes along with it is playing ping pong with those people like Barry, whacking the ball back over at people who want to take a shot at her.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there are people who don't like her, and it's like anything, though, when you get into a debate, whether or not it's with people over, you know, is Star Wars better than, you know, than Star Trek or what have you. You're going to get your Midler fans versus your Streisand fans, or, you know, who's better, Barbara Streisand or Judy Garland or what have you. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a futile effort. But I think the more interesting ones are when you start arguing about which period was better for her career.
Well, I think also, and Tracy, you might be able to speak to this too, that one of the ways in which I think she's edgy and she makes people edgy is that constant notion of transcendence. I mean, you know, Tom mentioned Frank Sinatra, who's the other obvious parallel to this. Sinatra at a certain point said, you know, I'm not just a singer. You know, I'm more than just a singer. I'm going to be a movie star. I'm going to win an Oscar. I'm going to, you know, even if we have to put a horse head in somebody's bed, I'm going to be.
Right. I think it's interesting also that Barbara, at least in her early years, really thought of herself as an actress and really initially trained as an actress and wanted to be thought of as an actress. And it wasn't until she started to sing that all of a sudden people started to view her in this other light. But she herself thought of herself first as an actress.
You actually can watch the trajectory of show business through that period with Sinatra and Streisand about going where the power was, because crooners were the center of entertainment, and then Sinatra wanted to be a movie star because that's where it was. Then ultimately Barbara wanted to be a movie director because that's where the power was at that time.
And so she did. All right, we're going to take a little break. I do want to encourage people to explore and visit Jonathan Tolan's play and his exploration of Barbra Streisand's world. It's playing at TheaterWorks right now through Valentine's Day, appropriately enough. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
And I sing a simple song. I've never been so much in love and never hurt so bad at the same time. I am a simple girl and I play a simple tune.
So I want to talk a little bit about singing specifically. We're talking about Barbra Streisand today, and we do have Tracy Moore here who teaches that kind of thing and does that kind of thing. So, Tracy, one of the realities, I think, of singing and singing superstars is that everybody winds up wanting to sound like them when, in fact, the reality is that they break the rules, and only they can break the rules the way that they're breaking the rules, right? If you're a jazz singer and you try to sing like Sinatra, your jazz teacher right away is going to say, stop that, stop that. He can do that.
Right.
You can't do that. Stop doing that.
Right.
And that Streisand really is breaking a lot of the rules, maybe starting with, you know, one of the basic rules of cabaret is kind of don't get in the way of the music. But she's very much, I mean, a lot of her vocal performances are kind of about the fact that she's doing them.
Yeah. I actually played a role called Friend of Barbara in an off-Broadway show called I Will Come Back. It had some original music by Timothy Gray. But the idea was, the premise was, the show was basically a Judy Garland retrospective, and they couldn't get Barbara, so they got Friend of Barbara, and that was me. So I spent a lot of time studying the way she sang, because I had to do the iconic duet with the Judy Garland character, the Get Happy, Happy Days. She does have such a terrific sense of phrasing, which is something I think she has in common with Sinatra. The thing is, vocally, she does so many things right. She's really not breaking any rules in terms of vocal technique. Her voice is spectacularly placed, and the way she uses the breath is tremendous. But I will agree with you that she does sometimes get, if you want to say, in the way of the music. I think one of my quibbles with Barbara has always been that I don't always like her musical taste, the songs that she chooses to sing. And I think maybe part of that may be that she has to pick material that will allow her voice to be the main course, so to speak, rather than Sinatra, who in sometimes you can think of him as pairing with those fabulous arrangements in a more collaborative way. So she doesn't really do anything wrong. She's terrific and spectacular in terms of phrasing and control and all of that. And her pitch is really flawless. She has got terrific intonation.
You know, let's talk about that musical taste question, because, Jacques, one of the things you said in the previous segment is one of the more collegial and friendly debates that you can have is the different periods of Barbara Streisand. And in that sense, there's no one thing that is her musical taste. I mean, she's been through, and Tom can maybe guide us even more explicitly through this, but she's been through a series of evolutions trending back in 85, as you said, towards show tunes and American standards after a lot of contemporarily composed stuff that might have seemed a little treacly to some of us.
Well, you know, and if you look, I think most people will say that the 60s was, you know, musically her best period in terms of her voice was an amazing out-of-the-box instrument. She was doing mostly standards. And the fact that she was able to transition in the 70s into doing pop music and the, you know, the Guilty album and Stony End and stuff like that, you know, people probably never would have thought that she would have made it out of being a cabaret or Broadway singer. So for her to be able to transition. And then in the 80s, for her to go back and do Broadway music, she was kind of trying to – I think that's where she, you know, would kind of waver. She would do kind of sludgy pop and then interesting projects. So, you know, I think that her career has been kind of a bit of a mixed bag in recent years in terms of singing stuff that, you know, maybe like her most recent album, I think, is really boring. Her duets album.
Partners, yeah.
Yeah. You know, she's just going back and doing old material, and it's, you know, it's straight
and
out of the
arrangements are not particularly spectacular.
No, and it's straight out of the Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, you know, end of career, you know, playbook.
Well, Tom, one of the things that she did initially, you know, and I do think that if you're going to be a superstar, you better master the medium of the moment or even the kind of the subgenre of the moment. And one of the things that she mastered pretty early on was the television special in the 1960s, where the television special was such a big thing. So that even the albums she released, I think, if I understand this correctly, in the 1960s, were in some ways outgrowths of these incredibly popular TV specials.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she is so smart about all of that because, you know, it was like with her television specials, it was Barbara Television before there was MTV. It was BTV. And, you know, she broke all those rules and she said, oh, you know, these specials usually are about the star and then has three guest stars. Not for me. I'm the only person on screen for the hour. And we're going to have two albums coming out of this television special. So, you know, there was this extraordinary cross-pollination going on. And just to add one other thing to that discussion about the recent work, you know, what interests me so much is not as much, oh, the 60s, maybe late 60s better than early 60s. It's that kind of, I call it my American studies approach. She's 73 years old. She sings standards, and she just had the number one CD in the country. It's unbelievable. That would never happen with anybody else. So to have, you know, the number one CD for six consecutive decades, a record I suspect will never be broken in our disposable pop world today, that's what interests me so much and how, through force of will, she makes that happen.
You know, I want to talk about something that one of the places I think the tension surfaces. And so, Tracy, in the 60s and 70s, I mean, American popular music is going through this transformation. And there's this kind of notion within the world of rock and roll and then the singer-songwriter revolution that follows the early days of rock and roll that artifice is to be stripped away and that production is to be simplified and that rawness is valued over polish. And there's a kind of sense of, you know, getting to the truth of things and maybe people writing the songs that they perform. And so she's swimming against that tide, sometimes unsuccessfully, but mostly able to flourish and thrive in an era where every musical trend seemed to be working against her.
Yeah, she did kind of maintain those big orchestral arrangements, and she's singing in her style. But I would say, in my opinion, that she is authentically herself, and there is a polish and at the same time a rawness to her vocals, in the sense that there's some there's a genuine quality there. There may be an emotionality there that So she is in some ways being as authentic and stripped away as she can be, although the accoutrement, you know, the orchestration and all that stuff remains very, to use the Yiddish term, schmaltzy.
Let's give an example of this, of particularly her trying to master the pop idiom and actually having, as Jacques suggested, a pretty big hit with this. This is a Laura Nyro tune. It's called Stony End. Let's hear what it sounded like. So, if you love Barbra Streisand, well, Jacques was beginning to boogie right there in his seat. If you love Barbra Streisand, then this is sort of great. You know, I have to say, to my ears at this time, I first of all couldn't even get really what the song was. There was so much. First of all, it's overproduced, and second of all, this is everything getting in the way of the Laura Nyro melody. This is a horribly unfair thing to do. I'm just going to play a little bit of a different singer, very obscure singer, Beth Nielsen Chapman, singing a little bit of this song. Same song. So, Tracy, you know, one thing that Johnny Mercer told vocalists was before you sing a song, write down the lyrics in longhand, particularly if they're Johnny Mercer lyrics, so that you really grasp it, you make it your own. And Streisand can really do that at times. You know, there are some of these highly emotive songs that she absolutely makes her own and it feels as though she has a tremendous emotional connection to. But that, to me, sounds like somebody just gave her that piece of material to sing and then some producer walked her through the paces. And it feels like the song is being destroyed somehow.
Yeah, I actually have my students do that as well, writing out the lyrics. I think it's a question of whether or not you're going to put lyrics first or notes first. You can argue that that's one of the main differences between, for example, opera and music theater, is that in opera, the notes drive the vehicle, and in music theater, the words are driving the vehicle. So I mean, I love both those versions, and depending on what I needed, balm for my soul, I would pick one or the other depending on what I needed. So I think there's room for both. I'm not going to disagree, though. She was definitely swimming against the current when it came to what was happening popularly. But to quote Thomas, you know, she's still got the number one album. So what are you going
to
do?
Well, I want to talk about what she does do really well when she does. It seems to me, and I think this, I want to talk a little bit about why she's a gay icon. And so I was trying to think about this. And it seems to me that gay icons either have a big secret or no secrets. Like big secret, like Betty Davis in Dark Victory. Or no secrets, symbolically, like Barbra Streisand, who in the sense, when she's singing a song, she puts it all out there so much that you feel as though she is sharing with you everything that you've got. And when you think about what gay life was in the 60s and 70s, where you did have secrets, you couldn't share your emotional life. Jacques, I'm talking about this like I lived it, I didn't, obviously, but I'm wondering.
It's okay, you can come out.
All right, okay. It has to happen sooner or later.
It's a safe space. Yeah,
so I'm wondering if that's part of it, though. It's like, this is somebody who's unafraid of connecting to her emotions and singing in the 60s and 70s to a subculture that wasn't always free to connect to its emotions.
Well, she says, you know, and I think this comes out of what Tracy said earlier, that, you know, she trained as an actor and she said that she loves acting songs. You know, for her, she sees songs as she says that she gravitates towards songs that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that she's storytelling when she's singing. So I think you know, there's an emotional journey to the songs, but B, I think, you know, that especially the the early stuff where there was just such a wide variety. She was being funny and she was being – I mean, I know that she may not be the best torch singer, but there were torchy songs like Cry Me a River that she was doing at the beginning. And so I think that and she had this weird sense of glamour and kookiness and – I don't know. I don't know if the other guys want to jump in on why they think this is the case.
If I could just add one quick thing, I never thought of Barbara as a particularly emotional performer. It's just that for me, the voice evoked emotion in me. I had an emotional response to what I was hearing. It's not like she gets up there and cries. And even in her interview, she's very guarded. This is not someone who's kind of letting it all out for the world to see.
Tom, do you want to jump in on this conversation?
I'm sorry, was that directed at me?
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering whether, particularly that sort of notion. I mean, it is interesting even to speculate why she connects with who she connects with.
Well, I think, you know, to me, this is sort of I'm answering the question, but slightly parallel when you raise the issue of a gay icon. I think the role these divas play, it's very interesting how it kind of parallels the, in a way, the evolution of gay life in America, because, you know, Barbara's predecessor as a gay icon was Judy Garland, and then it became Barbara, and then it became Madonna, and then it became Lady Gaga. So, and you can see the change, you know, with Judy Garland, it was about, you know, she had such unhappiness in her life, and there was such closeted gay life, and then it was Barbara who was the first to really demand a place at the table. And of course, in Barbara's case, said, I'll set the table and cook the whole meal as well. And then, with Madonna, that change in persona. So that's what interests me about that evolution.
That's, I think, absolutely the case. And maybe this sets us up as we head into our final segment. I mean, I was reminded this weekend, I was down at Goodspeed, where they are getting ready to do a sort of a bio musical about Judy Garland. And one of the differences is that Judy Garland's father was a closeted gay man, and that Judy Garland occasionally, either on purpose or by accident, married gay men. Whereas with Barbara, that seems to be, she's lived her life a little bit differently. So actually, why don't we take a break? We'll come back, because we've got to talk about the men. Come on, we've got to talk about the men. Thomas Santopietro will help us with that. So will Tracy Moore and Jacques Lamar. And here's some real emotive singing.
I was always certain love would grow. Love, ageless and ever. How far would I travel to be
All right, that is Barbara Streisand singing with her son, Jason Gold, her son by her first marriage. That was to Elliot Gold. So we're right where we want to be. We're kind of in the area of Barbara and men. But first, Thomas Santopietro, I just wanted to do a couple of other biographical things. Getting ready for the show, I read some things that completely blew my mind. She went to high school with Neil Diamond and Bobby Fischer and had a crush on Bobby Fischer. Do we believe this to be the case?
It's absolutely true, and makes me smile every time I think about Barbara Streisand and Bobby Fischer. And so, you know, when she did the duet, You Don't Bring Me Flowers with Neil Diamond, it's like they had come full circle back to Erasmus Hall High School.
That is just incredible. I mean, the whole thing is incredible. Yeah, I read that she, for 1 year when she was 16 and he was 15, she had lunch with Bobby Fischer every day at school. that I could have told her was not going to work out.
Well, you know, two misfits, their antenna were up. They right. knew that each was really far out there.
So this duet with Jason Gould, who is the son of Barbara, and Elliot Gould, of course, she met in I Can Get It For You Wholesale? Is that what it was? And he became her first husband. What can you tell us about her relationship with her son? Is this the fact that they're doing a duet significant in some way? I assume it is.
Well, I think the important thing about the relationship, her relationship with Jason, is that she always makes a point of being incredibly supportive in public and in private about what he's doing. And I think it's really to counteract, or she wanted to do the opposite of her relationship with her mother, who was always saying things to her like, you know, you're too skinny to be a singer, you don't have the right looks, you should be a typist. So I think she really wanted to counteract that and always be supportive. And I think they actually have a pretty good relationship.
So I'm going to ask you about this, Tom, but I'll also I would guess Jacques will have a few things to say about this. I mean, part of the Barbra Streisand story is this kind of really kind of interesting sequence of men, ranging from Elliot Gould to, I'll probably miss a few, but yes, we mentioned Don Johnson during those during the credits, and Andre Agassi, and of course Josh Brolin and Bill Clinton. No, just kidding. Although we could talk about that one.
John Peters.
Oh yeah. So there are. I don't know. I mean, maybe you can just say a little bit about this. That part of the journey that she's on in terms of the art that she creates, as is the case with so many celebrated entertainers and romantic figures, is paralleled by a pretty strong interest that people have in her love life.
Oh, I think absolutely. And particularly in her, and you know, the archetype of that for her, of course, is The Way We Were with, you know, Robert Redford, the ultimate golden boy. And I think what you have with Barbara is the parallel between that in private life, really wanting to be the attractive girl and attracting this strange, and let's not forget Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada, you know, all these extraordinarily handsome and accomplished men.
The first Prime Minister Trudeau. She's not a cougar. She's not going after this one.
And then, of course, that became really her biggest archetype of all her films, because when you think about it, whether it's Funny Girl or The Way We Were or The Mirror Has Two Faces, it's all about the quote-unquote unattractive girl getting the great-looking guy, and it follows him to the point just about 10 minutes before the end of the film where he kind of hits himself in the forehead and says, oh, but you are beautiful. And, you know, she's still working at that, and that really interests me, you know, at the age she's at. And, of course, what it really the message is that, you know, in her case, talent is beauty.
Jacques, how does the Streisand soap opera work for you? Is that part of the appeal?
Yeah, I mean, it reaches probably its sort of demented apex with Mirror Has Two Faces, especially when she's forcing Lauren Bacall to basically say, you are the pretty one to her. You know, it's and she gets a makeover from being Jalubby to Barbra Streisand. So, it is something to kind of interesting to watch. And I think that The Way We Were is kind of interesting because it does have that sort of ugly duckling captures the golden boy, but also is probably the most, and Tom may agree or disagree, I mean, you can look it up at the Sandbox, but also kind of captures her political, because she's a very political creature too.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this character that's very deeply principled, who also manages to get the gorgeous guy.
And we'll try to finish a little bit with the political part. But before we do that, Tracy, one of the things that I was thinking about, too, is there's always an interesting question with singers. We kind of want to know who they're singing about or what they're singing about, and we kind of don't. All right. So there's, you know, I'm just gay enough so that when Bernadette Peters is singing Not a Day Goes By, and I know it's about her husband who died like in a helicopter crash or something like that, you know, I mean, and she's weeping and I'm weeping. And just so knowing the subtext is at that point, I think probably enriches my enjoyment of the song. But with Streisand, I mean, there's just so much focus on her, you wonder. Although I guess when we listen to her music, we don't necessarily think of any particular guy.
I don't, but I know what you're talking about, that personalization where you really feel like you're getting a glimpse into what's really happening with that the singer. That can be very exciting. I'm always struck by the parallels in Barbara's life to some of the shows. Like if you look at Funny Girl, you know, the mother is not completely supportive in that, and she's wants the guy who's kind of this roué. And it's almost a trope in music theater that you have these people seeking this approval and acceptance from mothers. You've got Gypsy, which is sort of similar in that regard. And then you think about Sondheim's life and the awful things that his mother has said to him about, I wish you were never born. And I mean, it's just interesting to think about how much of Barbara's life is, you know, is a trope almost in some ways.
My mother, who drove me very hard, used to tell me that Norman Mailer's mother drove him hard too, and that I should be grateful for the psychological torture she was inflicting on me. So maybe there's that. Tom, not for nothing, but I think her latest publicly discussed project is a sort of a biopic of Catherine the Great, who also kind of, you know, had parents who didn't really give her everything she needed.
I know. It's such an interesting idea to me. And the rumors I've heard, but, you know, it's still at the rumor stage, is that they're talking about that Barbara would be directing Cate Blanchett. So that's a really interesting idea. And just to throw one other comment in, going back to Jonathan's play, because I think it's a really good play, and I really enjoyed it. And I think one of the things he hit on that's so ingenious is that by using, you know, the whole idea of Barbara with this mall in her basement, you realize that her obsessiveness is the source of her greatness as an artist. Mm-hmm. And it's also what makes her a little bit crazy and frustrating to be a fan of, but it all melds together. So, you know, using that device in the play, which is funny and touching, I think is a really good one.
Jacques, did she sleep with Clinton?
No.
I thought if I asked it really point blank, you'd know me about you.
I don't think so, Tom. Do you think so?
Well, I couldn't hear the first part of that.
Did she have an affair with Bill Clinton? I mean, it wasn't really a serious question. Although it's something that comes up a lot. I mean, if you read tabloids and stuff like that, there's even this idea that her praise for Hillary Clinton's candidacy has been fainter than it could have been because they're uneasy with one another because, like, everybody else that Bill Clinton ever met.
While we're on that subject, then you can throw in, you know, there were all the rumors about Prince Charles and when she did the concerts in London and sang, "Someday my prince will come." It's Trudeau. Throw out all. You can throw in any of the politicians.
I'd say Tung. Pretty much everybody, really.
There's been rumor of a that she's writing a book. Does anyone know if that's accurate?
She is. I mean, it's contracted and it's coming out in 2017.
All right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much, Thomas Santopietro. While you're waiting for that book to come out, you can read The Importance of Being Barbara by Thomas Santopietro. And thank you very much, Tracy Moore, for your expertise about singing. Oh, this is, by the way, her singing that song. She's singing A Sleepin' Bee. This is the first performance ever on television on the Jack Parr Show, guest hosted by Orson Bean. Jacques Lamar is the Orson Bean of Hartford. And here's Barbara singing on TV.
The ground when my one true love I has found.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa? Dad? Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, but you're coming in and out.
Of your life?
What? No, the reception.
I miss the way we were before cell phones.